Welcome to Unframed, a podcast which hosts talks and conversations about South African art and artists. I am your host, Anthea Pakroy. This episode is from a talk that I recorded at this year's Investor Cape Town Art Fair as part of their talks program curated by Tumela Mosaka. Thanks so much to the organizers of the fair for allowing me to record this session and publish it on the Unframed platform. If you're interested, you can read the biographies of the panelists on the website, unframedpodcast.com. Enjoy this talk entitled Artist in Dialogue, a conversation between artists Kemang Waluhulere and François-Xavier Goubre.
We're here today with François-Xavier and with Kemang, who are going to be talking with us, because I would like to open the conversation to the floor as well about the practice and the way they do engage through the work audiences in different contexts. So it's going to be quite informal. It's a group of friends. I see many friends in the audience, so don't be shy. Call our attentions if you have questions from the floor. And we're going to have a PowerPoint presentation, like a slideshow, running, just to show you some examples of the work of the two artists, and that could be maybe even an opportunity for us to familiarize ourselves if we are not as yet familiar with the work of Françoise and Kemang. So I'm going to go very briefly through their bios, also because I didn't know I had to do it, but also because they are so in demand and they've been participating in so many different events, so I'm going to cut it a little bit short, but just to give you a little bit of contextual information I think is important. So I'm going to start with François-Xavier Goubre, who was born in Lille in France and is currently living between, I guess, Europe and Abidjan in the Ivory Coast. And a lot of his work, as we will see soon, is connected somehow to these moving continuously as a pendulum between different realities and different dimensions. He graduated in photography at l'École Supérieure de Montpellier in France, and his work has been shown in many different venues lately. The exhibition Sogno d'Oltremare at the Museum Man in Italy, as well as the La Villette in Paris, then the Denver Art Museum, the Walther Collections in Germany, as well as the Cantor Fitzgerald Gallery in Haverford College, and his work has been acquired by important institutions such as the Centre Pompidou in Paris, the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, the Tate Modern in London, Queensland Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane, Australia, and the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Amongst his solo shows, as we said, there's going to be this year, I think that's probably what we might want to highlight. He's going to take part at the Les Rencontres d'Arles, which is one of the most important festivals of photography in the world, I believe. And obviously, he's here with his gallery. And if you haven't had the chance to see the solo presentation he has at his booth, I would recommend you to do that today after the talk. For Kemang is a Capetonian, so you probably all know his work, and better than I do, actually. He was born in Cape Town, and he has a BA in Fine Arts degree at the University of Witwatersrand. And he had so many solo exhibitions, of which I'm going to mention only a few, if only I could go back to the page. So he has solo exhibitions in Switzerland, at the Max in Rome, at the Deutsche Bank Kunsthalle, the Art Institute of Chicago, guest work in London, Lombard Fried Projects in New York, the Goethe Institute in Johannesburg in 2011, the Association of Visual Arts in Cape Town in 2009, and he's represented by Stevenson and Marianne Goodman Gallery. He took part in numerous biennials and periodical exhibitions, including the last Venice Biennale, I believe, and the Sharjah Biennale, amongst many others. He was a co-founder of the Cuckoo Collective in 2006, and we're going to speak about that a little bit, if you don't mind, and also one of the founding members of the Center for Historical Reenactments in Johannesburg. So, without further ado, if we can play the... I would like to start maybe this conversation by asking you something a little bit banal, but which I don't think is necessarily, is like, when was the moment where you guys realized that you were a fully accomplished artist with recognition? Like, not only thinking that you were an artist, but it was actually, your work was starting to be taken seriously by audiences and critics and the establishment, I guess. Is there any moment where you realized that there was like a sort of transition where your work started to be have a weight? You both have a mic. Or if you don't particularly like the question, we can move to the next one too.
I think for me, that's it's hard to answer that question because for the longest time, I didn't think I would end up as an artist, even though I was making art. Even up to the point where I finished my degree, I didn't think I would be a practicing artist. So it's a bit hard for me. And this happened because I went to university with the hope that I would become an art historian. And for me, making art was something that I was doing because I could do it. But of course, I was exhibiting locally and internationally at the same time. And that's just kind of, I found myself,
I do believe that you, Francois, started as a commercial photographer pretty much, or in the realm of photography, but not necessarily as an artist.
Yeah, as a commercial photographer, as an assistant before. And I think I wanted to be an artist. I was interested in art. I was jealous of my friends working and studying like visual arts at school when my parents forced me to study like scientific stuff. So it was a long journey to
get there.
Yeah.
So you were start doing like, side projects, your individual project alongside what you were, needing to do by profession, and then you gradually took over in a sense, right?
Yeah, in the commercial fields, I got the skills, and I think 13 years ago, I decided to do what I want to do, what I want to speak about, the stories I want to tell, and it started like this, the shift.
And how do you see the difference? And then obviously we're going to alternate questions, but how do you see the difference between working in photography in the domain of photography to core as opposed to working in photography in the realm of contemporary art? What do you think are the differences? Is there a different audience? Is there a different set of rules that you have to follow? Or?
No, you free yourself.
No, but what I mean, obviously, when you're speaking within the realm of photography as commercial photography, there could be a reportage, it could be journalism, it could be design, and I know that you've been working in many different kinds of domains in that sense. Obviously, the way you engage the audiences, because the talk today is also about how do you use strategies to engage audiences differently through your work. So I'm assuming that when you're speaking to someone who's looking at the magazine, for example, obviously you use a different strategy as opposed to when you are in a gallery or in a museum environment where you need to think about three-dimensionally about the way that the photography is perceived. And I know you work very tirelessly actually in kind of creating different compositions, different presentations, three sculptural presentations as well as installations. So it's not only straightforward photography as it would normally assume for standard photography parameters. I'm telling you everything.
You told everything.
I'm basically giving you the answer as well as the question.
Thank you.
And in terms of language and devices, really, that you can use quite repeatedly in your work. I noticed there are elements, the birdhouse is one, but the porcelain dogs, etc., which are quite recurrent in your work. How do they came into your vocabulary, and how do you use them, and how do they translate from body of work to the next? We actually have some images now running.
The material I've been working with for the last, 5 years probably, has been school desks, which I buy either from schools or at scrapyards. But these are old school desks which are being phased out of schools. In fact, I learned through acquiring these that a lot of schools close down in the country, which is quite sad actually. And this is how I oftentimes get the desks. schools that don't perform to a certain standard, mm-hmm. the government closes them down. So I'd been, so for me, I'd always been interested in education and history. And that was primarily because in my high school, we only did history for 2 years.
Right.
And we touched on South African history probably for only 3 months.
Why?
Which I found very sad as a South African and not learning about South African history. We learned about the Romans and everybody else except for South African history. And for me, this was, this sparked a curiosity and interest actually, which has been, I would say, the basis of my artistic practice. There's a desire to uncover, or there's a search for knowledge or memory and history. So the materials I've been using kind of speak to that in a way, directly and metaphorically.
Mm-hmm.
The porcelain dogs, it's something that's quite common in most South African homes. I would say working class homes primarily. And this is across race, actually. I grew up, obviously, mostly seeing it in black homes, but I've also seen it in white homes. And I think it's something that is shared across the working classes. So I began an interest with the dogs when I read, what's his name? Udlomo. He wrote a short story called The Dog Killers, which was about set in the mines in Johannesburg. But also here in Cape Town, when Simonstown was deemed a whites-only area, black folk were moved from Simonstown to Guguletu, and some other people were moved to Ocean View. So the colored folks were sent that way. And also people weren't allowed to have dogs, to keep dogs. So whoever had kept pet dogs, those dogs were killed. In fact, I'm told by a writer who had been moved, she said that actually there's a mass grave where they buried all the dogs in Ocean View. So the dogs, like I've been interested in the dogs also because when I was a kid, we had this superstitious belief that if you took the sleep from a dog's eye and put it on your own, you would be able to see into a spiritual realm. But I was too scared to try this as a kid. like, I don't know what I might see. So, but it remained with me. I became fascinated with this. And then I began to think about it more poetically, and then to rather think in what in art, in history they call period eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So I began to think about the dog sleep as a way of seeing through layers, whether it's layers of time or memory. Yeah, I think I'm talking too much.
No. Well, I think, you know, going back out now to Francoise, it's just, if I understand it correctly, your work also kind of relates to personal histories, but also in a way that how personal histories and biographies, they do have a collective dimension and a political dimension. So maybe we could speak now a little bit about your project in the Ivory Coast and how you eventually returned, because I believe your father was originally from there, although you were born in France, and this is almost like a return to your roots and also a way out to, I guess, to how to analyze or to reimagine by proxy your personal history by, you know, re-entering into the country and looking into the country with poetical as well as political eyes, I guess.
Yeah, so I was born in France from an Ivorian father, and my mother is French and Polish, so I'm kind of uprooted. And when you grow in France in the 80s, you don't find at school all the information of where you are coming from, so I think all my work is about filling the gaps.
Yeah, similarly to Kemang,
in my education, yeah, similar to Kemang. And I think I started to photograph abandoned buildings because there was this textile crisis in the north of France, which is Lille, is a kind of city like Manchester or Liverpool. And so we suffered a lot about this, and my father worked in a factory. And this abandoned factory became our playground. And then when I started photography, that was the first subject. And then I was curious about more about Africa and Ivory Coast and the other countries, and I started to photograph other abandoned places, but that was built during the colonial era. Mm-hmm. And just I started to question all these or independent countries deals with this colonial heritage, and how you deal with the function, and how you maintain a huge building, and what do you do with this? And maybe, yeah, you don't see anybody on my pictures because it's kind of empty, and I'm just questioning, I'm just searching.
Yeah, we spoke about the complete absence of, sorry, is it very loud? Sounds very, okay. The complete absence of the human body in your work, which does two things to my mind. One of which, obviously, without having a physical presence, is harder to locate it geographically. I mean, there's much more open interpretation of what their place could be or where it could be. And the other thing which does, it has almost like, by depriving any preset narrative, for example, like, you know, the north or western perspective or look into Africa, by removing the African body, in a sense, you're not validating stories which are built on their body by somebody else. So it's kind of something interesting. It's like displacing the images as well as not really giving you what you would expect it to get from a body of work made in a specific region. That's what I'm trying to say. And so this is your conscious choice. What's really your strategy by not giving any hint into that? It's really about, like, you know, creating a more abstract space, a more lyrical space without necessarily being so didactic, I guess? Mm. Or is there just avoiding other narratives that they might be put into your work by interpretation? Or I'm curious. I'm just literally, obviously I don't have an answer for that, but it was more my feeling looking at the work being so empty, right? And so present, and so the presence of a man work is evident in every single piece, but at the same time, there's no manhood or humanity into it.
Yes, I think there are two different ideas or two different approaches. In the track series with the old abandoned buildings, it's like I want to be, anyone could be part of the pictures, and to, it's like a theater, and you can go through the images by yourself, and they are abandoned, so there is nobody. Mm-hmm. In Abidjan, it's like I just want to show what the human are making. And how do we build our environment? And it's mostly this, and it's my own journey. It's not the journey of someone else. It's just my Abidjan. So
yeah.
And and you were talking about black bodies and white bodies, but in Abidjan you can find both, even
of course, no.
Lebanon bodies. So
of course,
it could be anywhere. So.
No, that's what I'm saying. But I mean, without having like the visual references, it becomes like, you know, sometimes I'm looking at the images. It could be like, you know, Eastern Europe, or it could be like, you know, so many different other places. And that's interesting how you know, the interplay. Because obviously, if I were to come into an image which obviously speaks of a specific region, I think I will bring my own set of knowledge of interpretation into that. By not having it, obviously, you know, I have to live in a different dimension in some sense. So I quite like the fact that it becomes so ambivalent and is not obviously so descriptive, right? In that.
Yeah, but in all my works, I try to have this confusion because I don't know. I'm just asking questions. So you don't know if it's built or if it's half destroyed, you don't know if it's under construction, and I like this confusion, like the not to know and always
which
always
direction
searching.
Is going.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your, both for both of you, I think, what's your kind of thinking process like? How do you start working on a project? Do you start, I'm assuming, by ideas, by sketches, or by intuitions, or what's your kind of production modality, if there is one standard one, or if every project is a different one, probably. But do you have a methodology for initiating the work?
No.
I kind of thought that you wouldn't. But
I mean, there is a kind of methodology in a way, but because my work is so different, it requires different strategies continuously. So if I'm working on a body of drawings, there's a methodology to that. If I'm doing sculpture or I'm working on a performance piece, so it's really, I would say it's governed by what the idea wants, because I think from a conceptual premise, and then it's about how does this thing want to materialize. There's only so much I can push, but also the ideas have to almost unfold themselves. A case in point is a project that I'm working on now, which is called I Love You Too, which will be hosted at the Zeitz Museum. And this is, it's a performance piece, but I'm not in the performance myself. I have a masseuse who offers a massage for free to the public. or to the museum staff, on condition that they sit with the writer while they're being massaged, writer, poet, / musician. Some of these people I'm working with, they dabble, or they're musicians who I consider poets. So they sit with the member of the public, and then they help them write a love letter, which they take home. And these letters will be archived, documented and archived, and will be published next year, July. So a project like that, for example, requires a different type of thinking. I can't have a methodology for that. I did some workshop in the museum to test it out before opening it up to the public, because obviously, like, a lot of things come up, especially when you're working with other people. And I assume, especially here in South Africa, with the kind of trauma that we have as a nation, mm-hmm. a lot of things are going to come out that already in the workshop session, one woman cried, which is not something I would have expected. I think it's different if I'm working individually or collectively, or if I'm collaborating with someone. It requires a completely different approach.
Sure, you say something about this last project, which was, it really touched me, because generally we know of the love letters only of the people who are famous or worth being reminded, and through the archives or through literature, but we don't really know much about the love of anybody else. And I think that's actually one of the most beautiful points of your project, is just to have all of this kind of wasted love, basically, which has no real anchor, no real point for collections and for resonating, really. I think it's a very, very poetic and touching project. I got another question, more still related to practice, I guess, and still related to how you develop your projects, but it's more related, I think, to authorship. How do you see yourself when you work as a collective, for example, and how do you see yourself when you work as an individual artist who often collaborates? I know that you do collaborate with many people, so it's never really a process in total isolation. And I think you also did a project in collaboration with people recently. Maybe we can talk about that as well in dialogue with what Kamanga is going to say.
Oh, I go first.
You go. Well, we were continuing the conversation. Yeah. we can probably have six of here. Friends of now. Because I think that's how I remember meeting you. You were still very active in both the collectives that we mentioned at the beginning, and then I think your individual career or individual trajectory became, very solid and very, very established. And so I wonder whether these collaborations are still going on, whether you still see yourself as, splitting your activity between these different dimensions, but most importantly, how do you conceive as an individual artist as opposed to, you know, a dialogue with other artists and practitioners?
So I think it was never really a choice to work collectively or not. Many years ago, we established the Ku Collective, which was a Cape Town-based art collective. And we started the collective for a number of reasons, which were, at the time, we considered institutional problems, both in Cape Town and in South Africa. Of course, the landscape now has shifted dramatically compared to what, 14 years ago. There's more institutions, there's women are more visible, a lot has changed. Of course, change can always continue, but I think a lot has changed from from then till now. So I worked with this collective for a number of time, and then I moved to Johannesburg to study, which really, yes, I did.
She agrees.
So I moved to Johannesburg to study, and this really affected the relationship of the collective. And because I was carrying a lot of the administrative work within the collective. Mm-hmm. So the collective took a knock from my absence, but also it shifted how I saw myself. For a short while, I was actually part of another collective in Johannesburg, which was called Dead Revolutionaries Club. So we published we had an online magazine, basically, it didn't do as much as we had hoped. But we also screened films, we held talks, we did exhibitions. And this was before I co-founded Center for Historical Reenactments with Ukabi. And Ukabi is someone whom I was always in dialogue with since I met her in 2005. And in fact, she had curated a show in 2008, which I think was quite key in my relationship with her in terms of how we would approach the Center for Historical Reenactments. Ukabi had been part of a collective which is very little known, actually. It was called Manje Manje Projects. Manje Manje means Manje Manje is, it means now. And she had this collective with Mwenya Kabwe, who's a theater director. So they curated the show called Scratching the Surface at a Ku Collective, at the Ku Collective project space. And there I did a performance where I was digging with an Afrocomb over a period of 3 days, and I discovered a skeleton. And this was in someone's backyard. And this discovery of these bones became like a haunting moment, both for myself and Ukabi. And we continued speaking about this performance and what it meant, even when she had gone to Bard College to study for her curatorial master's. And when she came back, is when we started the Center for Historical Reenactments. So there was always a dialogue that was happening. I don't work with Ukabi anymore. with the Center for Historical Reenactments, what happened was I moved to Amsterdam to go to the Rijks Academy. And of course, this again affected the relationship within the collective. Utona Kukam was also part of the collective. In fact, at that time, we were traveling so much, all of us, that it was becoming really hard to even for us to even have a week, just 1 week together, to think and work. So it became really difficult. Kabi was traveling all the time, Donna, and we were all in different directions. So it for me, it felt like it didn't make sense anymore to keep or to try and hold on to something if our individual journeys were going separate ways.
And I think for you, Françoise, it was more like a sort of a participatory project to become a sort of a collective work and enterprise. Can you probably just tell us a little bit about that experience?
With Yo-Yo Gontier, my friend, and we met like in 2009 in Bamako Biennial, and I love his work, and we started to look at the work of each other, and so we have our own project, and 5 years ago we decided to start to work together and to create new narratives with our pictures, but not only our pictures, but we invited other artists that we like their work. And there is this project, so the Courtyard La Courde, and in Bamako Biennial, when I was living in Bamako in 2011, 2013, I found out the old cinema, abandoned cinema in open air from the 60s. And this place is amazing, but it was like 20 years, there were no movie anymore. So we decided to reactivate the cinema. So we brought a projector, we cleaned the white wall, and we pasted huge photographs on the wall. So our photograph, but also photographs coming from archives and from other artists. And the idea of the courtyard is also to bring people to talk about art, so not only photography. And so we started to fix the cinema, we fixed the chair, we didn't want to borrow chairs from another place, so we involved the guy who made the
carpenter.
Yeah. So many people from the neighborhood came to help us, to paste the photograph, to clean the street around, and that's the way we run this collaborative project. And right now for this year, we are working in Clichy-sous-Bois and Montfermeil in France, in Les Banlieues. It's where the French riots started in 2005. So it's very complicated to go around with a camera there because I'm tired of people coming to look at them.
Yeah.
So the most important part of the work is to create a relationship and to talk with the people. And so we started to collect images that they did like when they arrived, maybe during the 70s. And so we are working on this, and we will do a kind of projection in an old place, an old gymnasium that will be destroyed. So we are working not only with other artists, but with normal people.
Is the cinema in Bamako still working? That was my question. Is the cinema in Bamako still working? Do you know? The cinema restored?
Actually, it became a venue for the inn.
For the last
Biennale.
Okay.
But the images are still on the wall.
They're still on the wall, okay.
Yeah, but it's much better because there is dust. It's a little bit dirty now, so it's much better.
Going back to Kemang Agot, I would like you to talk us a little bit about a project you did at Sharjah, because we spoke the other day on the phone a little bit about that, but I went to see the show without knowing the story, obviously, and so I kind of familiarized myself with the legacy of Gladys. But can you tell us a little bit about that project? I'm really personally interested, so I would like to share all of the information with you. So I don't know if it's an image of that necessarily and the one we have here.
Okay, so the work Lorenzo is referring to is a body of work that I developed in collaboration with my aunt, Sophia. And this began by a chance encounter, I guess. I was going to visit her, the house in Kugulethu, and then one of the neighbors saw my car parked outside, and they came with a book on Gladys Mkudlandlu, who is considered the first black woman painter in South Africa, or the first black woman painter to have an exhibition. So when this woman, the neighbor, gave the book, my aunt asked to see the book. And she said, as she was going through the book, she said, "Oh, I knew this woman." And I thought she was lying or joking. She said, "Yeah, like I used to go to her house as a kid." I'm like, "What?" She's like, "Yeah, she lives around the corner from here," which is where I grew up, so I was like, "No ways." So I went to find the house, and the man who currently lives there has no relationship to Gladys. And I began Also, my curiosity was sparked by the fact that my aunt told me that Gladys had painted murals inside the house and on the ceiling as well. So I went there, curious to see if these murals would still be there. And this is largely because I myself have been making chalk drawings. But not this particular image you're looking at, but these are chalk drawings with wall carvings, which actually, this is an extension of the ideas that come from this body of work. Mm. Because at the time, I used to make these large murals, which would then get erased after an exhibition. So I was curious about these murals in Gudlandlu's old house. So I went, and of course the murals were not there. But then I had to figure out the way of how to uncover these layers of paint. So I did some research, spoke to some conservators. I tried to get a hold of a camera from Sweden, from the, what's this camera company? So I found out that they had infrared scanning camera. So I got in dialogue with these people, but I think when they found out that I want to use the camera in Google too, they changed the story. But they actually referred me to like the regional manager here in Cape Town, who I met a number of times. So I had to again devise a different strategy. I was like, okay, shit. So fortunately, I met this woman called Bettina, who's an art restorer, conservator. So we went to the house and did some tests. And the man who lives there, like, he didn't care about art. So I asked him, like, with his permission, of course, to peel away some layers of paint. And he was okay with it as long as he said, I can do whatever I want as long as I fix his wall. Put it back to to whatever state I found it in. So we did some tests, and then, but in the process, I was at the time I'd received the Standard Bank Artist of the Year Award, and I'd been working on this body of work. I was meant to present a show for Standard Bank, and I was running out of time because of the back and forth with the Hasselblad people and the cameras and Bettina. Also, the man who lives in this house, he's mentally unstable. So he goes into hospital like twice, like once, like for 2 weeks of the month, he's institutionalized. And it's because of trauma that he experienced as a former military MK veteran who was part of the military wing of the ANC. So it was hard to access the house generally. I'd go and visit the guy. He didn't have a phone. It was really, so in the end, Gladys Mkulandlu's works were coming up on auction. So I started to buy them. And then in the meantime, like I kept questioning my aunt because I couldn't trust her memory actually, because she had suffered a traumatic experience as a teenager during the student uprisings. So I was like, I'm not sure I actually believe the story that there's murals here. So I invited her to the studio to come and recreate the images that she remembered seeing. And that's how really we began the relationship of me collaborating with her, which has been something that's been ongoing. So what I did eventually, I measured the room of the living room of this house, and then recreated that in the studio, but painted it with blackboard paint and asked my aunt to recreate the space as she remembered. So this I filmed. I think the film was on a charger also. Mm-hmm. I gave her smaller blackboards to work on, and chalks, which some of them I intervened in. So we collaborated in a way. Because I was running out of time and I'd wanted to present this project for the Standard Bank, I decided to pair mine and her works with Gladys Mkulandlu works that I'd bought. But fortunately enough, we did manage to uncover part of the mural, which is also in the film. So yeah, that
was a closure.
Yeah, but that happened really at the end. And also, the book was going out for publication. And I remember Sophie at Stevenson, who was working on the book. In fact, the day we uncovered the mural, she was sitting there in the living room because she had to send the book off for printing. But fortunately, we could document the process and then send it off. So it was quite a crazy period.
And going back to you, Francois, there's one work who's in this lecture as well, which I would like you maybe to tell us a little bit about, which is the Je suis africain in the Chinese lettering. Mm-hmm. That part of a project, I think it was very, very interesting. And if you could tell us a little bit more about that presentation, which I think it was he at the Dakar Biennale or?
And yeah, the Wolf Shifeizu. And few people understood it in that
the context.
They were not sure it was for me. And nice that I have been photographing like building site for years now, and in Senegal, in Mali, in Côte d'Ivoire, and everywhere I cross Chinese working. So I started to think about who is building a new Africa, who is African, and in this new world where everybody is moving, and sure, the people able to move, of course. And so it started with the plates where I found a dictionary, mm-hmm, where you can find the words in French and the Chinese and the translation in Chinese with only words that explain how to work, like sand, water, I mean the word you use on a building site, concrete, blocks, and so the work just come from this, because it happened in Abidjan, they were renewing the cultural center in Abidjan, and years before I photographing this Olympic pool in Bamako that was built by the US Union and that was renewing by a Chinese company like 50 years after. And in Bamako there were also this bridge called Pont de l'Amitié, from the friendship between China and Mali. And other cultural centers, Omnisport, and a lot of things, a museum in Dakar. So in this part of Africa, which is the one I know the best, I found them everywhere. So that's all the question.
So originally these were like basically a manual, a textbook for communication between Chinese and African people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And are there like on paper, or it was written on the wall? Your process was to first you photograph them, and then you start doing this kind of sculpture work out of it as well, right?
After,
this is something
with the plywood, which represent the same writing that the Shifeizu,
calligraphy of the Chinese, exactly. And so it really became an installation eventually. It transformed these motifs in different elements. And I think that, I mean, even now we're looking at it just behind me. I mean, it's so interesting how you're continuously stressing photography in so many different ways and creating continuously different compositions. And it's really not about a single image in my mind. You know, of course you can look at one in individual images as well, particularly when you do the billboard size, as in this case. You know, they become really iconic and very monumental. But I really feel that for you is important just to create all of these physical compositions with different type of photography, which kind of brings to life narratives. Can you tell us how do you conceive your shows, or how do you bring together the imagery, or if there is a specific process in that sense, or if it's conditional to the space where you're exhibiting work, or if you really feel that the body of work has, you know, comes together first and then it has to be installed into the space?
This comes from many things, I think. I'm working on several long-term projects at the same time, so for 2 months I can be working on one, and then I push another one, and then I come back, and I work like this. And my studio is the street, or at home, so it's small. So for years now, I use like this small print that you can find on the booth. So this is my kind of raw material, And one day with Cécile, we decided to frame it. And that's how I started to exhibit the small prints, because it's the one I use at home. And then to pass the large photograph by the street or in different places, like in the La Cour, the courtyard, the project, it's to give, I tried to share the experience I had when I was photographing a place. Mm-hmm. I don't know if...
This is actually driving me crazy, because every time I want to talk about something, it's gone.
But the idea is really to create a window on the landscape, or... Yeah, this monument could not be small, for example, before it has to be... It has to be huge.
Since we are hosted in the context of an art fair, generally all artists hate to see their work in their art fair context. Mm. What's your... Maybe we can just kind of close a little bit with some comment or notes on your relationship to either the art market or the art fair systems. How do you see yourself in all of these different environments? Because obviously, there are commercial galleries, there are public galleries, there are museums, there are different type of institutions, there are schools, there are, academic or educational work, and then obviously there is a market which is a quite big sector and is propelling us all in one way or the other. So do you have any comment you want to share about your relationship of your work seen in the context of an art fair? And it is a different place, right? And so also a relationship, I guess, to collectionism is also interesting, how you see the work being entering collections, etc. I mean, it's something that artists need to start thinking about, right? Not just only leaving them in the booth. What's your relationship to the art market? That's the simple question out of it. And how you see your work into that context. I know it's an uncomfortable question, but I think we know.
So I was having a conversation with Nicholas Lowe about this many years ago, and he said to me, museum exhibitions are great. They cement you somehow in art history, but they do not sustain careers from a financial perspective. My relationship with the market, I don't know, the thing is I don't think about it much anymore, I guess this is because I've discovered that anything can be bought, which for me, it used to be a bizarre concept, but I think I've resigned myself from trying to understand. An example would be for the show I did at Gasworks in London, where it was for the first time I did a wall carving. A collector requested I walk through the show with her, privately on a Sunday morning. So we met and I gave her a walk through the show. And then she requested we walk back to the wall carving, and then she asked me, how much is this? So I looked at her thinking, you can see this is the wall, right? She was like, yeah, we can cut it out. And I was like, what? She was like, yeah, we can cut the wall. I was like, wow. So...
she must discern it.
So I was like, okay. But I never gave her an answer, really. She wanted to know how much it was. And I was like, and I think I've since realized that, anything can be sold. And the thing is, I don't concern myself much anymore with the market. Of course, it's good to be in collections, both private and public. I don't know.
I think you gave us a good example, actually. Do you have any interesting relationship to other collectors, or the way how, like, you know, work has been collected? Because, I mean, they're also productive ones. I mean, there are some luminaries amongst the collectors who are really supportive, and they become, like, you know, really patrons and friends eventually, you know, of artists as well. I mean, there's also very good philanthropy going on, but obviously there's the other side of it, of the market, which is speculation, and it's really about the having, like, you know, the hot name and making sure that they're going to be pumping up into investment. So I'm not demonizing anything. I'm just really curious about, like, you know, because obviously I always look at this more from the eye of the institution, which is a sort of a filter, I guess, between the two realms. But I'm also very interested in understanding, like, you know, what's the response of the artists who, in proximity of art fairs, are demanded to produce more, to, you know, create outputs, to actually give work to the gallery exhibition. So there's a lot of pressure, I guess, as well, right, from that relationship. And so we never really hear your story. I mean, the story of the artist, other than seeing the work hang in the booth. So maybe that's the opportunity to give us some insight, if you want to. Otherwise, I'm going to open the conversation to the floor.
Now showing on a booth, it's only for 5 days, so there is always frustration because you have been working on it for weeks or months. And what we try to do with Cécile is to show several parts of my work and a way to be generous, just to give more. Then we don't know if it's going to work with the market.
We hope, right?
Well, is there anyone from the floor who has questions for our wonderful artist? And I can come and bring your the mic, or don't be shy. Or for me, obviously, right?
Hi, I just wanted to touch on one of the Hmong's images that we've seen. It's the one with the crutches, and it looks like a Bible. Like, maybe you can just talk us through your thinking there.
That piece is called Broken Wing. I don't remember what I was thinking there, actually. No, I'm kidding. So that's a work I made for the Deutsche Bank Award exhibition. And for that project, I had researched an area in Simonstown called, it was formerly known as Luyolo Village. Not many people know about this. But some years ago, after I discovered the mural in Gudlanju's house, I hosted a workshop with professionals from different fields, from the government sector, curators, academics, and I'd hosted this workshop with the intention that they would help me think strategically how to move forward. At the time, I'd been considering purchasing the house and turning it into a museum. And that's why I've been collecting Gladys Mkudlandlu works over the years. So in the workshop, my uncle was also present there. He commented that actually, which I'd never thought about, he pointed out the fact that Mkudlandlu was painting houses on hills, and a lot of people thought these houses were depictions of houses in Guguletu, because Gladys Mkudlandlu, along with my family, are part of a generation of people who had been forcibly removed from Athlone. In fact, she used to live in Athlone with my family, so my family actually knew her from Athlone before they were moved to Guguletu during apartheid. So a lot of the writing has been alluding to the fact that Mkudlandlu was painting these houses in Guguletu. But my uncle said there were no houses on the hill like she was depicting in the pictures. And that's something that struck me. And there was an architect who was actually in the workshop. And she sent me a picture a few weeks later, of a photograph of Luyolo Village, which was an area in Simonstown where black people lived, but this area was removed. So we began research into the area with Ilse. In fact, out of the workshop that I hosted, another collective was born called Pamphlet, which was myself and Ilse Wolf, who's an architect. So we did research on the area, and the work, that body of work, was premised on the research I was doing in Simonstown. I feel like there's a lot of things I want to say, but I'm not sure if they're coming out correctly. We also did a publication called Gladiolis, dedicated to Gladys Mkudlandlu and Gladys Thomas, who we published her work in the, as part of the Deutsche Bank publication. Inside there's another publication, which is a pamphlet. So as part of this process, I also met a lot with Gladys Thomas, who is now quite a forgotten poet. Her poetry came out in a collection with James Matthews in 71. And became the first banned book of poetry in South Africa. So she helped me a lot in thinking about, and she's the one who told me about the mass graves. So she helped me a lot in thinking about the show. The piece is called Broken Wing. And I was referencing the fall of man and the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. In fact, on the map of Simonstown, there's an area called Eden next to Luyolo Village, which is something I was kind of entertaining conceptually in thinking about this region as Eden and the expulsion of black people from Simonstown to Guguletu, which is where I grew up. So hence the work and the Bibles and the crutch, which are made from school desks. But I've later destroyed the work, actually. Or not destroyed, but disassembled it and used the materials for something else. Yeah, and this is largely because, which kind of speaks to the market again, it was hard for the gallery to sell the work. Because it's quite a huge installation piece, yeah. And also installing it is quite, it's very complex. It's super, super complex to install. But also like storage itself, because it's so big, is an issue, so.
Well, that would have been a perfect museum piece, actually.
Yeah.
For a more permanent display. Yeah. I can imagine not having a commercial, it needs a commercial life, let's put it this way. Is there any other question? Yes.
Okay, so I really tried not to speak, but I'm still asking one question. I'm speaking a little bit, it's a bit selfish, as I work in a museum, but because we've been addressing the market, I thought it was fair to think about museums, even though Kemang said museum shows are great, which I'm really happy to hear, because working in a museum, I often think they're not. But I was thinking, yeah, about, because actually it's a question I'm asking myself, so it's a question with S, but I wanted to hear you both on that since you're here. Are you concerned about, I mean, you both kind of operate from very profound contexts of history, multi-layered histories that navigate and circulate as well, but that needs some kind of grounding, education. I mean, South Africa, of course, I'm more familiar with France, even though I try not to spend too much time in France, but even colonial history is not, we don't really learn about our own colonial history in France. So how do you, And are you concerned about the fact that your work, even though it can be read in many ways and it's multi-layered, can be misunderstood or wrongly framed? Or, yeah, I mean, since they, you know, they belong to specific places, to contexts, to you need sensitivity, and you need also kind of educational background, or at least just they need to be grounded in a history that is always, if I look at the history, the 20th century history, which is displayed at the Centre Pompidou, which is the museum I operate from, there's no space for like even mentioning, you know, the independence of Algeria. So this history is not there. So how do you, I mean, do you think about that? Are you concerned about this? The way, I mean, things can be translated or misunderstood.
Well, for me, I think I like misunderstandings, actually. I think they can be productive, depending on how one kind of takes this. In fact, there's a work which is called, I have a text I wrote called A Grave Misunderstanding. It reads, Scene 55, A Grave Misunderstanding. And there I was playing on the word grave as in serious, but also like grave as in the burial. And this was referencing to the performance piece where I dug and discovered the bones. But also when I was in Ireland on a research trip, I had a dream that I found bones in a pot plant, but they were infant bones. This was meant to be my last night in Limerick. And Goyo had invited me there. She was curating the Limerick Biennale. So I had this dream, I found these bones. And because I had found bones before, like I was quite edgy the whole day, and it was meant to be my last day. So I told Goyo that I asked her if I could stay another night because I had this very unsettling dream and I don't know what it meant. And when I told her the dream, she said, she told me about the history of the Magdalene laundries, which in Ireland they used to take women who are either considered too beautiful, young women who would be seen as, who would possibly tempt married men into cheating, or if you had a child out of wedlock, they would send you to these laundries where you would work there for the rest of your life, basically as a prisoner type thing. And the story was that a few years ago, while preparing to build a building, they were digging and they found this mass grave of like infant bones. Because the church, sometimes the women who were pregnant, they lived in horrible conditions. And they would, some of the babies would die at birth, or they would die like really very young as infants. So Goyo told me this, and then she took me to the art school, which formerly the building used to be a Magdalene laundry. So of course I didn't find any bones, but I think that the dream was speaking to this history. And then, so I wrote this text, I'm talking about the misunderstanding. Now it says, Scene 55, A Grave Misunderstanding. I once mistook odontophobia as a fear of death. Upon reading its meaning twice, I realized it was an abnormal fear of teeth. This is curious because an artist once said, teeth are the only bones that show. While digging in someone's gray backyard some few years ago in Guguletu, I discovered bones. Where I come from, people go to a special school to learn how to read bones. Once read, these bones are said to unveil the past and or uncover the future. So for me, the misunderstanding, I welcome misunderstandings. I know obviously that we don't see the same things in the same things that we see collectively. And this is also, I mean, I think the question of context and being understood or misunderstood is one that, for me, my own existence and every articulation can be misunderstood. Someone could misunderstand how I'm speaking now about generating a conversation, and that's a risk that we are constantly taking. But I think for me, what's more important is to speak about the narratives that I speak about, the histories that I've been searching for, the history that I wasn't taught to bring it to the fore. Yeah, but now I think I'm tired of history, to be honest. So that's why I'm moving into love. But also I think, and it's quite a challenge for me because I was chatting to an artist in New York recently, and he said we need to create different images of ourselves, and which I agree with him. And again, I remember having conversations with Tim Ngosi, and he likes to reiterate the fact that we are not because of apartheid or our history, but we are despite of it. So, yeah, anyway, I think I'm going to keep quiet.
Do you want to add something for that?
Yeah, but Alicia, you know, and I think all the work I do is I'm just trying to fill the gap coming from my education, and I think the things that we didn't find into the books when we were younger, and I'm just working on this part of memory, so maybe our works are just an option to the book, and just bringing annex to the history, or to think about it in another way, and if there is misunderstanding, it does not matter. It's just like the Woishi Feizu piece. I think it was misunderstood in Dakar, but let's see in 10 years.
Well, I think this is with both answers, I think this is a close for today, because I think it's about time. So thank you very much for joining us. And most importantly, thank you both for being here this afternoon. And I would also like to thank Laura Vinci, the director of the fair, as well as Tumelo Mosaka, who organized this series of talks and who have been generously inviting us here today. So thank you very much, and have a wonderful
thank
afternoon.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you to the panelists and to the Investor Cape Town Art Fair for letting us publish this talk on Unframed. Don't forget to follow Unframed on Instagram and Facebook, and subscribe on Apple Music or wherever you get your podcasts.